Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for January 26, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And here we are, 2 days after what some British psychologist identified as the most depressing day of the year. I guess we're now on our effective upswing, having passed that hideous milestone. We've got two segments up for tonight. First, in about 5 minutes or so, we'll be speaking with Stephanie Hendricks, who is the author of a new book from Melville House Books called Divine Destruction, Wise Use Dominion Theology in the Making of American Environmental Policy. She and we will be joined by Ron Arnold, who is Vice President of the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise, the coiner of the word phrase wise use, and regarded by many environmentalists as a Satan incarnate. So he will, and he's a target of much of Hendricks's book, so he will be able to respond to what she says. And then just after the half hour, we'll be joined by two people who are members of a group that is putting out a blog called Against the War on Terror. And they have some serious problems, not only with the war on terror, but also with the way the war on terror is, or the critique of the war on terror is being framed. And we will ask them, Alex Gurevich and Aziz Rana, who will be joining us in the studio. We will ask them what their particular beef is. And before we get to the first interview, just a quick review of some of the economic headlines. First, this morning's tally of weekly jobless claims, that is the number of people who just lost their job and headed over to sign up for unemployment insurance benefits, a very sensitive and very useful indicator of what the state of the job market is like. That was up 11,000 last week after a very surprising 36,000 decline the previous week. And as you may have remembered that I mentioned last week that there was some skepticism about last week's number because of some problems with adjusting for the Martin Luther King Day holiday, but the rather small rebound this week suggests that maybe this is something real and that maybe the pace of job loss is slowing significantly. That doesn't necessarily mean that the pace of hiring is accelerating at all, but it does mean that the pace of job loss does seem to be slowing down. And this does have a good record of correlating with what's going on with the broader job market and with the economy. So this is an optimistic indicator for those people who make a living by selling their labor power. Another job indicator, though, the Conference Board's tally of help wanted indexes in newspapers flat again at a very low level, 39. The 1987 average was 100, to give you an idea of what of how low it is right now. Now, this indicator is lost some of its significance because of the growing importance of online job recruitment and the declining importance of newspapers want ads. But one does suspect that the month-to-month movements are suggestive of what's going on with the cycle rather than the long-term trend. And this has been stuck pretty flat for more than a year now, 3 years now, actually. So this arguing against a significant acceleration in the job market, which, as I keep saying here, has been anemic over the last several years in its performance throughout this economic expansion. The Washington Post ABC News weekly measure of consumer comfort, as they call it. There's three principal measures there: consumer comfort, the University of Michigan's consumer sentiment, and the Conference Board's consumer confidence. The other two are monthly, this one weekly. It took a big dive last week. Well, it regained most of what it lost this past week. So that number is not so great, but at least there seems to be no continuing decline in consumer attitudes. Now, that is useful for at least two reasons. One is that it's a reflection of what's going on with people's finances, what's going on with the job market, how strapped they feel. But it's also a measure of or a projection of how aggressively they're going to spend money and give us more of that delightful thing called economic growth in the near future. So a good, if not great, number. Now, the housing market, which, as I mentioned last week, the interview we did with Dean Baker, suggesting that the great housing bubble does show some signs of losing air. It was reported, yesterday, the day before, That the sales of existing homes in the month of December off very sharply, 6% in the month of December relative to November, and below what most people were expecting, a further sign that the housing market is slowing down. But this could be a very, very long process. It could be drawn out over the next over months and years. But it does at least suggest that something is going on there. But to the contrary, the Mortgage Bankers Association measure of new mortgage applications up on the week, and also their measure of mortgage refinancings up on the week. So there's still some life in the housing market. There's a downtrend in this measure that began in the early summer and extended through a couple of weeks ago. And now we've had a little bounce back, but so far no sign of a real reversal of that trend. But it will. It does suggest that this unwinding of the housing mania is going to take some time. And then finally, the Commerce Department, Census Bureau rather, reporting that new orders for durable goods, those designed to last 3 years or more, and a measure of both long-term economic confidence, but also an important source of demand, both business and consumer demand, that up a healthy 1.3% in the month of December. Very under the surface, we learn that non-defense capital goods, excluding aircraft, that is machinery, basically, computers and drill presses and all kinds of other industrial machinery, very nice gain in the month of December after several months of negative or near zero numbers. So it does look like a business which has seen very, very high profits but has been very reluctant to invest or hire using those profits may be loosening the purse strings a little bit. But, of course, 1 month does not a trend make, as they say. So let's take a little musical break, and then we'll be back with Stephanie Hendricks and Ron Arnold. A song I played several times in this show, an excerpt from Bad Religion's Los Angeles is Burning, which is a nice setup for any segment on environmental or social catastrophe. And that's what this next segment is about. Divine Destruction is the title of the book by Stephanie Hendricks, just out from Melville House Books. Wise Use, Dominion Theology, and the Making of American Environmental Policy. Stephanie Hendricks, a longtime broadcast journalist and has been a producer for Pacifica Radio, so that's something of an in-house person here. Welcome to WBAI, Stephanie Hendricks.
Thanks so much for having me on, Doug.
Divine Destruction, Wise Use, Dominion Theology, and Making of American Environmental Policy. What is this wise use thing all about, and how is it connected with sort of catastrophic Christian views of things?
Well, your next guest, Ron Arnold, will be able to give you more from the horse's mouth the definition of wise use, but I'll try to do a thumbnail sketch so we can get into our discussion with him. I actually want to give a little context here. I was hired as a journalist to find out who was attacking the very carefully prepared plan to manage the federal forests in Sierra Nevada. And everyone was expecting the timber industry to be the bad guys and trying to destroy the forest there. And it turned out, actually, I discovered a group I'd never heard of before called the Wise Use Movement. And this is a very broad coalition of people that Mr. Arnold actually has pulled together in a very efficient fashion. And one thing they all have in common is using public information and twisting information around to bring in an anti-environmental policy and sentiment in American popular culture that support corporate agendas that don't want to be accountable for the environmental destruction that they're doing. I'll give you an example of this. Mr. Arnold's, one of his partners in his think tank, the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise, Paul Dreesen, has teamed with Niger Ennis of the Congress on Racial Equality. I'm sure WBAI listeners are familiar with this, that this organization. But they're campaigning to pit environmentalists against African Americans by saying that environmentalists hate black people because they don't want DDT to come back into the environment. The claiming that DDT is the only poison that can cure malaria, malarial mosquito populations in Africa. And it's a disinformation campaign, for one thing, because DDT is not the only thing that can deal with mosquitoes that carry malaria in Africa. But the bigger tragedy is that these same chemical companies that have given Mr. Dreesen the money to do this stockpiled tons of pesticides, literally tons of them, in Africa in the 70s and 80s. They're now corroding and contaminating aquifers. There are cancer clusters, birth defects, developmental problems, reproductive problems. So Africa's already been attacked by these chemical companies and poisoned, and now they're trying to use African Americans to do it again. So these are the kinds of disinformation strategies that they were able to pull together, the Christian right, to help pull together the Christian coalition. Now, in my research for this, I'd never really heard of a lot of these groups, like the Wise Use Movement, but within the Christian Coalition, there are a group of people calling themselves Reconstructionists or Dominion Theologists. Reconstructing the Word of the Bible is where that term comes from. And for many of these people, they believe, or they try to get others to believe, that we're in end of times now, and that it's prophesied that in order for Jesus to return, Armageddon has to happen. And there are some of these people within these groups that are actually promoting that that George Bush is the person divinely leading us into Armageddon, and that, you know, we are in end of times. And another figure who I'm not sure whether Mr. Arnold who I'm not sure if he knows or not, I'd love to find out, is Tim LaHaye, who wrote a popular series called the Left Behind books, which are supposed to be fiction, but have sold over 70 million copies and have created this culture of Christians who believe that we're in end of times and sort of fostered this whole thing. Tim LaHaye also is a founder of the Federalist Society, which WBAI listeners have heard many times, probably on their air, as being a think tank for anti-environmental, anti-social justice judges. They claim to Alito and to Roberts. Tim LaHaye also was one of the founders of the Council on National Policy and the Christian Coalition. So there are people who have been working to promote industry values through Christian propaganda. And the good news...
Yeah, no, I just... this is a familiar pairing in American politics now. And on the one side, money interests with very clear material issues at stake. Sort of pairing with people with a theological, a right-wing Bible-thumping view of the world. How much overlap is it, or is this just a marriage of convenience between these two sides?
Oh, I think it's a lot of overlap. If you look at James Inhofe and Bill Frist and Rick Santorum and all the new Christian right people in Congress who are voting right along Ron Arnold's kinds of wise use policies, which are anti-environmental, and if you look at it, political appointees like Stephen Johnson, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, he attends an evangelical church in Maryland, yet he has got a new rule coming out this week that advocates human testing of pesticides on pregnant women, neglected and abused children, and children of limited capacity. I mean, these people, whether they believe it themselves or not, we may never know, but when we look at if they call themselves Christians, and they're politicians, and they're in government, and they're doing these kinds of actions that are really destructive to human beings, and as well as to all life on the planet. As one of the evangelists that I interviewed, who used to work with Rick Santorum, says, look at their actions, and you'll see if they're Dominion theologists or not. I do think that some of it is manipulation. I think some of the people could care less about religion who are pushing the religion, and they care more about the profits that they're getting from the corporations that are pushing this. And I want to make a couple of really clear points here. One of the things that I discovered was that there were a lot of fundamentalist evangelical Christians who don't interpret the Bible that way and who interpret that we have to restore the earth. And they are in Washington now having holy wars with these dominion theologist types and with the people in office. And they're arguing, like Rich Cizik is from the National Association of Evangelists, that global warming has to be a number one priority with our government. And so it's not an across-the-board kind of thing, and it is hopeful to me that there are Christians that are interpreting the Bible a different way and that are challenging this and pointing this out. And just like there are corporations who are moving towards sustainability and who are realizing that they can't continue destroying things or they're not going to be able to make a profit. It's unprofitable to destroy the environment. So I want to be clear that this has got a lot more texture and complexity in it than we're probably going to be able to present here today. But, you know, it's definitely something we're up against, and it's an ideology that's driving a lot of our environmental policy, and we're all affected by it. We're all victims of some corporations who are driven by greed to want to make a profit at the risk of our environment and our public health. So that's what, and they're using religion to do it. So that's, in a nutshell, what I'm about.
All right, that's the voice of Stephanie Hendricks, author of the book Divine Destruction, just out from Melville House Publishing. And waiting on the line has been Ron Arnold, who is the Executive Vice President of the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise and pretty much the inventor of the Wise Use Movement. Welcome to WBAI, Ron.
Thank you, Doug, and I'm pleased to be invited.
Yeah, it's been, we had you on here years ago, but it's been quite some time, so welcome back.
Thank you.
Any reactions to what you just heard from Stephanie Hendricks?
Well, the title of the book really ought to be Divine Deception, because most of the things I read in there, it was the first time I ever heard of them. If I'm supposed to be the machinery behind the Wise Use Movement, which is not an organization, never was, it's kind of like saying that the environmental movement is a group. Well, no, movements are all very segmented, a lot of different kind of groups, every kind of opinion you can think of. So the characterization kind of goes back to something that happened during the... I noticed that Stephanie goes back to Jim Watts' quote that Coleman McCarthy, who was a Washington Post syndicated columnist for, nearly 30 years, first came out with, and that was this thing that Watt was supposed to have said at a hearing. It had something to do with this religious thing, that he doesn't know how many future generations we can count on before the Lord returns. Well, and the mischaracterization was, that's all he said, and that meant that, well, we can tear the hell out of everything, and it doesn't really matter what we do. And as a matter of fact, that's a total mischaracterization. It is casting in a false light. I mean, if a good libel lawyer was there, he would tell you not to say things like that without telling you what he really said. And it wasn't in the Senate hearings that was to confirm Watt. It was in a House welcoming hearing, let's get to know each other kind of session that's commonly done with new cabinet members. You go to your appropriate congressional committee and say hi and let them know what your policies are and answer questions. A guy from Oregon at the time was a representative sitting on the what was then the House Interior and Insular Affairs Committee. Now it's the House Resources Committee. And he asked Watt, and I've got this straight from the unadulterated, unchanged, original transcription of the verbatim words that were taken down by the stenographer, a court-type stenographer that they use in the House. They use tapes now. It says, Jim Weaver asked Watt, I wonder if you agree also in the general statement that we should leave some of our resources, I'm now talking about scenic areas or preservation, but scenic resources for our children, not just gobble them all up at once. And here's exactly what Watt really said. Absolutely. That is the delicate balance the Secretary of the Interior must have to be steward for the natural resources for this generation as well as future generations. I do not know how many future generations we can count on before the Lord returns. Whatever it is, we have to manage with the skill to leave the resources needed for future generations. Well, now that's quite different. And this business about the Lord, there was some bandying about before that. In fact, the next thing Weaver said was, Mr. Chairman, he was talking to Mo Udall. Morris Udall was presiding over the committee at the time. Said, I want to conclude, I might, seeing the secretary brought up the Lord with a story, and he goes and tells a funny joke dealing with religion. So the whole thing was totally mischaracterized as to what Watt's intentions were, as to what his program really did, and many things that he did have been characterized totally falsely as destruction, and in fact they were not. They were the things that built your buildings, built your machinery, built everything that you use and everybody uses to stay alive, and nobody gives them the slightest thanks for doing that.
We lost 14 million acres of public, taxpayer-owned forest land under James Watt, Mr. Arnold, and not only that, but he did comment to Austin Miles, an evangelist who had a religious epiphany and finally confided this in the public, that until the last tree is felled, you know, that he was going to keep going. His actions were so anti-preservation and being a steward of the earth. But you know what? You're doing what you do well, and I've got to say to you, now that we're talking sort of face to face, even though we're hundreds of miles apart, that I really appreciate being in dialogue with you and talking with you. And can I ask you a question?
You can.
Do you mind? Are you Christian?
I am not. I'm not religious in any sort, nor have I ever been. I was raised by my grandparents. My grandpa was an agnostic of the Robert Ingersoll stripe. My grandma was a spiritualist of no particular church. And I don't even know what that means because I was just a little kid.
Okay, so you don't believe in God or at
no,
all?
I don't have any of those kind of religious beliefs.
So I noticed that you live in a really beautiful place in Bellingham, Washington. When you go out and see those spectacular mountains and everything, do you have any stirring in your soul at all when you see the beauty of nature?
That is a really vicious question, Stephanie.
That's a vicious question? Well, how can that be a vicious question?
I'm asking you
if you're moved on a soul level of the beauty of nature. And I'm just asking you.
As a matter of fact, I'm looking out on a more beautiful scene than you are, where I feed the squirrels and raccoons, and I have a huge forest. That's my backyard. So how can you promote
the destruction of that environment? And how can you threaten, you said that you wanted to kill the F-U-C-K-E-Rs, referring to environmentalists. In other words, you would like to kill me.
I certainly did not say that. And I talked to our lawyers about that, and they said, well, that's fine. They've obviously libeled you. Now, what harm did it do you? Have you suffered a loss of members in your organization? Well, no. As a matter of fact, there are many people who were so tired of what environmentalists were doing to them, making them lose their jobs.
So you say that you did not say that. Did you ever say we want to destroy environmentalists by taking away their money and their members?
I most certainly did say that after the original quote was misquoted in a newspaper.
Why do you want to destroy people that protect the very beauty that you live in?
Because they're actually just doing a lot of fundraising for ideology, just like you claim your opponents are doing. But, Stephanie, if you'd ask me
what do we have to gain from it?
The book,
Ron, what do we have to gain from it? We're not going to make money off of it. Most people who work in environmental advocacy are poor. They're not making money. You say you're agnostic, but Sun Yang Moon has proclaimed himself the Messiah in the Dirksen building in March of 2005.
If you'd had the decency to call me up and talk to me about before you wrote the book like journalists do, this would all have gotten washed out, and you'd find out that I'm not at all who you characterize me to be.
I would love to sit down and talk with you, Ron.
Sorry to interrupt, but there was so much
information from you that was documented from other people. I had more than I could fit in there. So, you know, and also,
right,
I mean...
Time out here, just a second. I should say that we're hearing a sparring match between Stephanie Hendricks, author of the book Divine Destruction, and one of the book's prime targets, Ron Arnold, who is the Executive Vice President of the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise. But Ron, I know we've talked many times over the years, what interests me is that you think that environmental issues really are inseparable from property rights, and that when we have things, large federal public land holdings, that's really not the way you'd like to see our environmental resources managed. You'd rather see them in private hands, right? Is that correct or not?
No, that's not correct. We understand how things evolved. As a matter of fact, if you take a look at all of the things I've actually written instead of what other people said I said, if you look what I said in my books, and I've written 9 of them, you'll find that I don't have any problem with the federal government owning those lands. They're federal lands. They're not public lands in any shape. They're federal lands. They're political lands. They got that way for very good reasons. We don't have any problem with that. What we're looking at is that ones that were originally, let's say, 100 years ago, set aside deliberately by Congress as being, let's say, the timber basket, the place we're going to cut and regrow trees permanently using what's called sustained yield management when there is a Sustained Yield Multiple Use Act of 1960 that we supported. And that I think most of the people that are in the wise use movement, although, you know, there's a lot of them that call me names because they don't agree with what I do or what I think. But as far as there being public lands, no, there are federal lands, and I have no problem with that. And the main thing that I've seen happen is that the designations of how you can use those things, where you can use them productively, where you can actually get products from them, do a decent job, and come back and learn from your mistakes, as you're always going to do, and try to do it better and better as time goes on. I have no problem with that. But what I have a problem with is people who have institutionalized cash registers that need to have crisis management. They have to build a crisis if there isn't one in order to keep the cash register jingling.
But speaking of cash registers, I mean, you came into this business. You did publicity for Weyerhaeuser, as I recall, at one point.
I was an independent. You talk about poor. You should have seen me when I quit Boeing to become a filmmaker and a writer, which is exactly what I was
for many years. When did you work for Dow, Arnold?
I had a contract with them that never existed. I've worked with two or three chemical companies on contract to develop particular stories about particular things, and that was it.
But you were promoting 245E, which is Agent Orange,
by the EPA. That's one of the two components. There's 24D is another component of it.
Well,
if you read my scientific papers about it, because
they've both been outlawed and they're both deadly. How can you promote poison? I don't understand.
Well,
I'm a mother.
You call it poison. If you want to call it...
Well, the people who have Agent Orange syndrome can tell you how it's affected their lives. I know Vietnam veterans that are just tormented by this chemical, not to mention people I've met from Vietnam.
You're talking about. In federal forests, that Agent Orange was never used. Only one of the components, 245T, was used. 24D was used totally separately. It was never broadcast sprayed. It was always high target sprayed. And where there was drift, those things were prosecuted.
You know what? There is always drift, Ron. There's no way to spray without having drift.
Well, look,
Ron, you mentioned cash registers on the part of the environmental movement, but aren't the cash registers of the timber industry and the chemical industry a whole lot larger than those for the environmental movement? And you know, the whole point of this wise use movement is to give a grassroots appearance to what is actually a big moneyed interest, isn't it?
Well, actually, that's not. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons I got the idea was a guy named Herb Schmertz, who this is back in the, I think the 70s, wrote in Fortune.
He created those mobile ads in the 70s.
He was the mobile guy who did a whole bunch of stuff, and he said something in outside of those ads, which I thought were very provocative. And in a Fortune magazine article, he said, "You know, business and industry is the only major portion of American society that has no citizen constituency." And I said, "That's not right." You know, I look at all of the benefits I get from there being a technological civilization.
Customers. They're called customers. What do you mean they don't have a citizen? They don't exist without the citizen constituency.
Well, we're not
and
talking about that. Okay, well, that's the same thing I could say. All of the people who belong to the Sierra Club are their customers. That's stupid. That's not the same thing
at all.
It's a
market-driven thing, isn't it? Don't businesses exist because of human beings who are citizens,
the nonprofit environmental groups. They're market-driven the same way, and they have to manage their market just like anybody else.
But what are they selling? They're selling clean air, clean water, clean
earth,
a sustainable future.
No, they're selling propaganda just like anybody else.
They're future, Ron. Do you still believe there's no such thing as global warming?
I never said that. I said that global warming... certainly exists, because take a look. If you happen to be sitting where I'm sitting, if you were here 12,000 years ago, there would have been about a mile of ice on top of your house. Now, That's because we're just coming out of an ice age.
The average temperature. So our emissions have nothing to do with the global warming that's going on now?
Well, I'm afraid we're going to accelerate the process of global warming if we keep this up. And we've just hit the half-hour mark, and I've got to bring this to an end. So thanks to both of you for joining us. I can give you each other's phone numbers. You can carry on all you like.
Yeah, Ron, I would love to talk with you.
When I get back to the office, I'll send you each other's phone numbers.
We need to get together.
All right. Thanks a lot, Doug.
All right, that's Stephanie Hendricks, who is the author of the book Divine Destruction, just out from Melville House Books. And Ron Arnold, who is the Executive Vice President of the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise and really the creator of the Wise Use Movement. And let's take a break for a station ID, and we'll set up the next half hour.
Hi, this is Steve Earle, and you're listening to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio. And support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
And the show is Behind the News, and this is WBAI, 99.5 FM on your radio dial, and WBAI.org on the web. And be sure to check out that website. Let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with the critics of the War on Terror.
We need a war.
An excerpt from, and I know there's nothing more embarrassing than yesterday's hipsters, but that was Fisher Spooner singing a song with lyrics by Susan Sontag, We Need a War. We've got plenty of them running around. And now we're joined in the studio by Alex Gurevich, who is a graduate student in political science at Columbia and has written journalism in the American Prospect, the Washington Monthly, and the website Spiked Online. And Aziz Rana, who is a third-year Yale Law School student and a PhD student in political science at Harvard, both at once.
Yes,
you're a busy man. Welcome to both of you. You are... among the five of you who behind the website Against the War on Terror, which is at againstwot.com. That's againstwot.com, Against the War on Terror. And of course, many of us are against the war on terror, but I think you've got not the standard critique. You're concerned about the use of fear in politics and the use of legalism in arguing against it. So let's start. You've got a little manifesto on the website. So why don't you just recount your first principles from which you started all this?
Well, I think that the basic concern is that one of the things that we don't focus on with the war on terror is the fact that it's actually a product of our own domestic political culture. Namely, the fact that we've elevated security into the primary language that we have for talking about politics. So that when we talk, for example, about healthcare, we talk about health security. Or economics, we talk about economic security. And that in point of fact, what we see with the war on terror is that we've now used terrorism as another way of elevating security, of of attempting.
Well, what's wrong with a little health security or economic security? I mean, if you lose your job, you don't want to end up in the sidewalk. So, say if you have a little security against that, what's wrong with that?
I think the basic point is that it can't be the primary goal of politics. That it's a precondition for all the things that we do. If we only think in terms of risk assessment of the ways that we can ensure that we don't die, if it's just the baseline for how we discuss the things that we want, in point of fact, we've evacuated all the things that we care about from political life, that we can only pursue projects and goals once we have a certain condition. But if that's all that we have as a language, then we aren't really talking about anything.
So what have we eliminated? What's missing from the picture?
I mean, I suppose the point is that we're not just trying to survive. I mean, it'd be great to have health security and economic security, but that's not the only thing we want. That's just the problem with making that
that's a prerequisite rather than end goal.
What we want to be is be free. And we want to be able to pursue projects that are fulfilling and meaningful in life. And the problem with making security an end rather than the means is it's a way of really lowering our expectations about what we get from society and what the aims of politics are. Another thing about it is I think security has become a really common language because we don't really know why we want the things that we want. So I remember I used to work for Progressive Magazine. And there was a debate there about, why can't we just take the language that Bush is talking about, security, you know, the war on terror, we can be safe, and use it to justify there were a bunch of guys who were kind of into national health care and Social Security being run by the government. And they said, well, let's talk about this in terms of security. And it seemed to me that's just kind of a bad faith argument. First of all, it's not really going to get you what you want because it's only going to convince people of the need for a minimum rather than enough to really live well. So that you can then really be free and go do things that are meaningful. But it also is bad faith because it makes you think, well, why is it that you really want national health care? Why is it that you really want to socialize things? This is why not just come out and say it, that there's really an independent principle, set of principles, liberty, living in a free society, that can justify a much more kind of expansive view of what institutions are supposed to do for us.
Well, there are contrasting views of freedom. One is sort of classic right libertarian view of freedom, which is just the absence of constraint. Then there's a more sort of usually associated kind of left-wing body of thought of freedom being a much more positive notion of self-expression, self-development. How is what you're talking about relating to that classic opposition?
Well, I mean, I personally think of myself as coming from the left-wing tradition. But in a way, we're almost starting from a prior position, which is it would be great if that were the debate, if our society were organized around the debate about what does living in a free society really mean. Is it simply about rule of law, protecting property rights, so on? And then people go off and
that great Lee Greenwood song, I'm proud to be an American because at least I know I'm free.
Yeah.
But that's a contentless freedom.
Yeah.
We don't know what that means, do we?
That's precisely the problem now, that when you hear Bush talk about things like freedom or democracy, it doesn't really have any content. The only thing that we can actually give as sort of like a specific voice to it is the idea that, you know, democracy means being in a position where you can survive, where you have all of your bare necessities provided for, that you're not subject to violence, and perhaps you have regular elections. And that's a kind of base vision of both freedom and democratic politics that has all sorts of corrosive effects. It means that when the U.S. attempts to export democracy abroad, which seems to be a principal project of the war on terror, that it has no idea of what, in fact, it's exporting. It's just exporting institutions without any sort of basis, and it ends up, you know, taking a grab bag approach to how it pursues its projects. You see this.
Well, if you look at the behavior of the Bush administration, it seems to be about secret prisons and unlimited executive power, and that's not what we normally think of as democracy. I should say the last voice you heard was Aziz Rana, and the other voice you heard was Alex Gurevich, and they're both part of this project Against the War on Terror, a website, Against WOT. It's all one word, Against WOT .com. You have some posts on the website that are critical of the critics of the policies I was just talking about, the wiretapping executive power, for being too legalistic and not arguing from principle. So could you expand upon that critique?
Yeah, I think that there are two basic criticisms. The first is the criticism about constitutionalism, that one of the common points that you hear being made is that the administration is behaving in an unconstitutional way. But the problem with this argument is that it doesn't take into account that really over the last 100 years, we've developed a kind of constitutional regime that's built on executive action, particularly in foreign affairs and war making, that assumes that that Congress will be deferential, that the judiciary will play a minor role.
Which it usually is.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that in point of fact, the regime that we have is one that's predicated on expanding the power of the executive. Even the examples, for example, of judicial restraint, like the Hamdi decision in 2004. This is when the Supreme Court essentially established what it thought were due process requirements for enemy combatants caught abroad in the war on terror. Those due process requirements were remarkably limited. They only provided for a military tribunal with a presumption of guilt, with hearsay evidence allowed, admissible, with no judicial review. And so to claim that the administration is behaving unconstitutionally presupposes that there's something actually, you know, that there's a system of checks and balances that limits the president in the first place. In a weird way, the critics actually have a more distorted vision of what our constitutional regime at the moment is than the Bush administration.
Well, it's odd for me to find myself saying the Bush people have a point, but they do have a point when they say that Congress gave them a blank check in the days after 9/11, and they're just writing checks on that account, right?
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely true. There was a really interesting article in the Boston Globe Ideas section a couple of weeks ago which says this has been the history of Congress is actually to say that what the president's doing is usurping power is misses the point that Congress regularly has passed laws just handing power to the executive. Schlesinger talks about it in his book, The Imperial Presidency. But I think the other point that brings up is that the concern with whether actions are legal or not kind of misses the point. The question is whether this is a good use of power, legal or not. It's a way of avoiding having a political argument, which is, are we at war? Should we really be at war? Who are our enemies? Are there really enemies out there that are really going to completely destroy us? Or is the threat actually really exaggerated? And so the concern with whether it's legal or not really kind of misses making those – is a way of kind of avoiding making those kind of more important political points. But – and it also misses
the – Why do you think there's so much focus on the legalism and reluctance to argue from principle? Is it – we're just such a shrunken perspective in this post-Cold War world?
Yeah. I think that's – I mean that's a – which I did have to be unpacked, but I agree generally that's true. I mean, one reason is that I think a lot of the people, the kind of judicial activists, have somewhat given up on the court of public opinion. And there's a bit of a kind of – they've just given up on mass politics, you know, in a way. And they just think, well, we're going to achieve our ends through the courts. And
well, not now, they're right.
They're not, well, it's strange that they still take that perspective, though. I mean, I know so many people who are convinced that this is the way to do it, is to show them to be illegal or show these actions to be illegal, and that's the way we're going to criticize the Bush regime. I mean, not only is it a really problematic thing in terms of how you go about developing a real kind of democratic agency that's, you know, going to really oppose the Bush and oppose Bush and the war on terror and hold them to account kind of in a democratic way. But it's also – it has a really skewed view of what the judiciary really can do in terms of political opposition.
There are two sort of connected points to this. The first is that I actually really think that it shows a real hopelessness on the point of view of opposition, which is that there's this sense that if only we have – you know, the Fitzgeralds out there, if we have the right prosecutors, the right judges, the right lawyers.
It gives me the creeps to root for prosecutors myself,
no,
but
kidding.
I'm just
an
old lawless dude myself.
Then all the good things that we want will take place, and it's a way to avoid the real difficult work of actually developing a sustained political opposition that's built on a social movement that has, you know, a party platform that's committed to meaningful change. And another reason...
Could I just say one thing on that, which is that people forget the ACLU started as a social movement. It used to, in the early 10s and 20s, its main political activity was actually organizing people and holding protests for civil rights, and that was how it really tried to win political victories. And then over time, it's become much more legalist as a kind of – it's a small example, but of a general shift towards courts, giving up on people, as it were, and almost kind of thinking of them as part of the problem rather than the solution.
Well, let's part – there's a chicken-egg issue here. It'd be nice to parse for a little bit. Did this liberal emphasis on the courts come from a despair about popular political activity, or did it cause it? The shriveling of popular political activity, or did they happen together dialectically, separately? How do you read that?
I mean, I would say it was a dynamic process. I mean, you say dialectically, that sounds about right. I mean, I think that there was it kind of emerged around signature events like Brown v. Board and Roe v. Wade. I think for a lot of liberals, those seems to be defining moments. And that was a kind of – I don't know. That was an ambiguous moment in our history. It could have gone a number of ways.
But those were like 50 and 30 years ago.
And those – yeah. But it's interesting to hark back. I mean, when you think about it, it's kind of funny that those are still the landmark events, because you think if those are your only victories in the past 30, 50 years, maybe it's time to reconsider your strategy. But I think it also – those were in the scope of the demands being made. Those were actually conservative strategies, you know, in the broad scope of kind of criticisms being made of American society. And so I think it did subtract energy from kind of more democratic and progressive forces that existed in society.
Yeah, I mean, another related point is just, you know, there has to be a recognition of just how difficult it is to develop sustained social movements, that these aren't things that emerge overnight and they take a lot of work. And one of the things that law does is it allows you to circumvent those problems. And so it's, you know, it's a very attractive strategic tool precisely when it's incredibly difficult to maintain political opposition. And the connected point to the security question that we're raising is that it's precisely when you have a political climate that's motivated by security talk, really on both sides. It's the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats is not that one doesn't use the language of fear. It's that they use the language of fear for different ends. So you have Graham, for example, when he was running in 2004 for the presidential nominee, was saying that, you know, the reason why you shouldn't vote for Bush is because he's not protecting us at home. He's not protecting our trains and our harbors. And that this is a kind of language of fear that produces an atomized public where, you know, if you're afraid of what you can do, you don't go out and join collective movements or think about ways that you can pursue politics in a solidaristic manner. Instead, what you do is, you know, you go home and you close your door and you put, you know, duct tape on your windows. And you – so
well, if I was a conspiratorialist and a cynic, I think that's the point of that kind of discourse, the discourse of fear, is to disarm and alienate and demobilize a bunch of people.
Yeah. I mean, that may be – I mean, I think historically that's often been a reason for invoking national security emergencies and kind of war is the health of the state. You kind of try and repress or kind of shut down debate at home and conflict at home to kind and kind of send it abroad or at least just prevent it from articulating itself. What's odd now, though, it's hard for me to really see what the interests are that are being served by all this security attack, or it's just not as obvious to me that it's really about kind of trying to kind of repress really active left-wing movements out there, because there aren't really any. And, you know, that's pretty disorganized
and weak.
No,
but it did manage to get Bush an 80% approval rating at one point, which is eroded.
But very short term. I mean, it doesn't seem to me have worked for Bush that well, actually. It's been a very short-term strategy. And I think, in a way, it was more that Bush actually thought it would work to kind of re-enchant the kind of really floundering presidency. I mean, I didn't really love Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11 that much, but my favorite part about it was the beginning, where he shows that before 9/11, this was a president who didn't know why he was in office, who had very little sense of what to do while he was there. He lost control of the Senate very quickly in that kind of unprecedented move by Jeffords. He had the tax cut issue, but besides that, there was really nothing to give him, nothing connecting him to the public.
And there's something about that Jesus put him there.
And now he thinks that Jesus, you know, and in a way it's true. It was a kind of divine agency that gave him a sense of purpose, because he certainly didn't have one. It kind of really literally came out of the air. But it doesn't work. I mean, it's, as Aziz said, it's really atomizing when you kind of invoke security. Just make people stay indoors.
Aziz being Aziz Rana, and the voice you just heard was that of Alex Gurevich, and they're both part of a group that produces the Against the War on Terror blog. And we see now the Bush administration really kind of fighting back pretty hard on the wiretap issue and saying they're doing it to protect us. And instead of retreating, they're actually going on the offensive with this. And most of the critiques of the wiretapping has been, as you point out, very legalistic. It's unconstitutional. They didn't go through the right channels. But if you were, you know, out there doing politics or advising somebody who was, how would you meet this Bush administration offensive, making a principled argument against surveillance and executive power and wiretapping?
I think the first point to make, and this is one of the difficulties with the arguments that the Democrats are making, is that the original FISA Act itself is deeply troubling. That what it did is it created a secret court that can provide domestic surveillance with a very reduced standard of probable cause.
And they turned down, I think, 5 out of over 20,000 applications in the course of this.
And I think only one.
Yeah, I think that the
Workers' Vanguard said it was 5.
So okay, 5, fair enough.
Four of the 5 actually were on technical matters.
Oh, really?
What ended up happening was that they just simply, you know, reproduced the warrant, and then it was accepted, and it's only been one that was turned down finally. So the point is that the conversation that we're having already presupposes that somehow the 1978 law was itself a reform, which is something I actually think I heard on the news in the last day or so. And the point should be, you know, should we have a FISA court in the first place? I mean, it's essentially the equivalent in today's politics of the Star Chamber that, you know, that we saw hundreds of years ago in England. And the fact that we have a Star Chamber that's being defended as a basis for liberal critique is problematic.
I would just add to that. I mean, let's just face it. We shouldn't be at war. And, you know, the justification Bush is given for this wiretapping and a lot of the perfectly legal things.
In wartime.
They
use that phrase constantly.
Yeah, I mean,
in time of war.
Yeah. I mean, we're just not at war. I mean, this is not an enemy. There's a guy holed up in some caves in Afghanistan, and the terrorist threat is just wildly exaggerated. And right. I just think that's something
he emerged
people
from his
have
cave to deliver an audio tape the other day,
yes,
which now has thinking of him over again.
Which is bizarre. I mean, it's really, I have to say, Bush has elevated bin Laden's status in a way that he never could have done on his own. I mean, by taking him much more, by turning him into the representative of a kind of state or someone that he could actually be at war with, he's really massively, he's created something out of almost nothing.
Radical Islamism generally. I mean, in a way that radical Islamism was in its death throes at 9/11, and what Bush has done is given it energy.
But I would also say, I mean, yes, sort of, but what strategy would I say? Say, look, we know that actually it's pretty easy to commit a terrorist attack in the U.S. I mean, everybody talks about it incessantly. You can't protect all your ports. You can't protect all your bridges, all of
it's
the buildings.
Actually been it's remarkable right? Nothing has happened.
And
it
exactly,
seems so easy to blow up the George Washington Bridge.
Exactly. I would say that's the best piece of evidence we have that actually there isn't this tremendous – that this threat is being wildly exaggerated. There are other good pieces of evidence. I mean, when I was working as a journalist, I looked in – a lot of times Ashcroft would give these briefings when he said, look at all the terrorism-related convictions we have, and this is a sign that on the one hand – they're always stuck between on the one hand saying that things are going really well and on the other hand reminding us that there's still this really big problem. So I went and looked and tried to figure out, well, who are all these terrorists that were showing up? Well, 66 illegal Mexican immigrants in North Carolina who have been convicted on immigration violations that have been recategorized as terrorism-related convictions, or a guy who kind of violated some airplane law because he was drunk and kept pressing the tendon button, and that law happened to be under the broad category of terrorism. A lot of the stuff they're talking about, these are just not terrorists. And the relations, you know, or their connections with terrorism are just really loose. And we have to be willing just to say, look, the threat is wildly exaggerated. We shouldn't be at war. We shouldn't accept this as a political argument about the use of powers, legal or illegal. And that's just the – I just think that's the argument we have to be willing to make.
Yeah, I remember during the 2000 campaign, Bush said, when I was coming up, as he said in that, you know, faux Texan way of his, we knew who the enemy was, but – now we don't know who the enemy is, but we know he's out there somewhere. Mm-hmm. But there's that act of faith. He's got to be out there somewhere, and if he's not, invent him, right?
Yeah. This is the other thing that was, that 9/11 provided for the Bush administration, which is that there was a real ideological emptiness at the heart of their politics, and that's that they had no clear idea of what they should pursue. And you see this even after the 2004 election where, you know, their attempt to actually invest domestic politics with a goal, with Social Security reform, completely floundered because it didn't have any substance. And what?
Well, now it's going to be health savings accounts.
Yeah.
Right.
The wave of the future.
Yeah. But
the State of the Union, I guess, will be the opportunity to rediscover the agenda on Tuesday. You were arguing on the blog that the great neocon ascendancy was never as great as a lot of people thought, and now it's kaput. We only got a couple minutes left, but what's that all about?
I just think the neocon. I mean, what's all about neocons is this. This has turned into kind of a bogeyman, and it's easy to critique a conspiracy because it's easy to cast it as evil, but the neocon ascendancy, it was a couple of individuals who within about 6 months to a year of the Iraq invasion were all pushed out. Jay Garner, Douglas Faith, Wolfowitz, from Pearl. None of these guys have
that. I love they said Wolfowitz to the World Bank as if that was a demotion.
No, exactly.
Even though billions of people in the world depend upon the World Bank.
Well, it is kind of a weird thing. And I don't know if anyone's ever heard Faith, but he's kind of a moron. I have to say, I was shocked at how there's no way this guy could have planned a conspiracy because he's just not that bright. These are a few guys who had influence in part because Bush needed a foreign policy and it was the one place where he could try something out. But in fact, it seems to have utterly failed. I mean, it seems to me what's pretty clear about this project is that it's failed. And quite quickly, he shed them and he just kind of retreated into this isolated state where he surrounded himself with Rice, Rumsfeld, and Cheney. And it's become more of a small coterie of trusted advisors.
And almost what's more interesting is the fact that critics feel the need to have mm-hmm. a neocon conspiracy or an industrial military complex conspiracy. It suggests that, one, we don't really understand why the Bush administration's behaving as it is, and we also can't really explain the events that we see as the product of, you know, of actors who, for a variety of different reasons, pursue specific objectives. We have to imagine that there's some kind of, like, structural project out there that we have no control over, that's bureaucratic and beyond our own capacity for change. And it just suggests how disconnected we are from politics.
I'm afraid we have to end it there. My personal theory is it's the decadence of the American ruling class that the Bush administration expresses.
Yeah.
But more of that in the future. Thanks to the two of you for joining us.
Thank you very much. I've
been speaking with Aziz Rana and Alex Gurevich, who are part of a collective that produces Against the War on Terror, a blog, Against WOT, all one word.
And we just add that we're going to be holding a teach-in as well because we'd like to engage people in
and
New York.
That, yes, February 25th, Saturday, February 25th, you can find out more about it at the website againstwot.com. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this 1996 version of Nick Lowe singing a song made famous by Elvis Costello. Bye.
As I walk this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity, oh yeah, I ask myself, is all hope gone? Is there only pain, and misery? And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I wanna know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, understanding?